Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
This is NPR News. It's 9:06.
Good morning. I'm Stephanie Curtis, sitting in for Carrie Miller. I hope you had a good weekend. It was so gorgeous out. The political junkie is off today, so instead we're going to start with a conversation about American diplomacy. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee votes tonight on the endorsement of CIA Director Mike Pompeo for Secretary of State. This comes at a big moment for Trump's foreign policy. The U.S. and South Korea are making diplomatic inroads with North Korea. Last night, South Korea even stopped blasting K-pop at the DMZ. Pompeo has already met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, and if Pompeo is confirmed by the full Senate, he seemed poised to step into the lead role in Trump's foreign policy team. Now, that seems like an obvious statement. He would be Secretary of State after all. But there are a lot of foreign policy advisors on the presidential team, and the State Department isn't necessarily at the center of setting the agenda for America's role around the globe anymore. That's our topic for this hour, the future of American diplomacy. Our guests are Uri Friedman. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers global affairs. Welcome, Uri.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
And Emily Tamkin is a staff writer for Foreign Policy. Welcome, Emily.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And of course, we want to hear from you, too. Call us 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. What should America's role be in the world? If we put America first and are isolationist, does that cede our leadership or does it keep us from overextending ourselves? 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Now, Pompeo is expected to not be given the endorsement of the Senate committee, but through Senate rules, his name will probably be brought to the full Senate and he'll be voted on. Emily, is he going to be the next Secretary of State?
I'm sort of loath to make any predictions about U.S. diplomacy at this point. I do think that ultimately he will be the next Secretary of State. That said, he obviously faces an uphill battle.
Why is he facing an uphill battle?
I think it's how U.S. senators are trying to express their frustration with President Trump. I think that Pompeo has said and will say what he thinks senators want to hear in order to win this, in order to become the next Secretary of State. But he was chosen in part because his foreign policy is closer in line with President Trump's own view. That's according to Trump himself. That's a scary prospect for some in the U.S. Senate.
Uri, do you think that he's going to get nominated? If he's going to become Secretary of State, and what do you think could stand in his way? What policies?
I have also been very wary of predictions, but yes, I will make one anyway. I think he will. I think this will be, we shouldn't underestimate how historic this is in the sense that usually Secretaries of State nominees get through the Senate Foreign Relations Committee with an approval. So the fact that he might not and it might go to the floor of the Senate is a big deal. It says something about the opposition to him. But I think ultimately he will become Secretary of State. And in terms of, when I've been hearing from Democratic senators in terms of their objections to Pompeo, I see kind of three strands. One is that he is hawkish. He himself says he's not a hawk and he doesn't like that term. But they say that he is hawkish and kind of trigger happy in terms of using the military or at least not investing in the softer side of diplomacy. The second factor is things that he said that don't necessarily have to do with foreign policy, but are more about, for example, comments he's made about the LGBTQ community, also comments he's made about Muslims and extremist Muslim views in America and people he's allied himself with who have very much more extreme views on kind of jihadists trying to infiltrate the United States. And then thirdly, and this I've actually heard From Republicans, too, like Senator Bob Corker, who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, is that there is concern that Pompeo may not serve as a check to the president, that he may be a yes man who doesn't actually challenge the president in ways that Rex Tillerson, his predecessor as Secretary of State, did, and the way that National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, who just left, is believed to have. So there's concern that he will enable the president, which is, you can understand concern among the Democrats about that, but the fact that some Republicans are voicing concern about that says something about what some Republicans fear regarding the president's impulses on foreign policy.
Well, Tillerson and McMaster served as a check, but also did they get much done? Without being in lockstep with President Trump, can you get anything done?
I would say H.R. McMaster had a semi-successful tenure. He certainly was very involved in this pressure campaign on North Korea and was at the forefront of he was almost like the intellectual architect of that policy. So I think he had some success on a policy front. Personally, with Donald Trump, I think he had a lot of friction, and a lot of it had to do with personal chemistry. I think there was a lot of talk and reporting that Donald Trump found his briefings kind of condescending and long-winded, whereas Mike Pompeo, for example, who currently serves as CIA director, has apparently, according to many reports, found a way to brief Donald Trump in ways that really gets through to him. Rex Tillerson really struggled. He was, he himself was involved in the dismantling of the State Department to a degree in terms of not filling staff positions and advocating for budget cuts. But he also, from almost the very beginning, had a very bad personal relationship with Donald Trump. And one of the big concerns there that really does have an effect on America's role in the world and U.S. foreign policy is I think there were a lot of diplomats and his counterparts in other countries who just didn't feel that Rex Tillerson spoke for the president. And this wasn't just some kind of, weird thought on their part. There was real truth to that. When you see Donald Trump on Twitter undercutting Rex Tillerson, for example, on his outreach to North Korea, well, that tells you that they are not in lockstep. And I think one thing Mike Pompeo would bring to the table that would be very valuable in terms of U.S. diplomacy is that I think, at the moment at least, a lot of people would interpret whatever Mike Pompeo says as coming also from the president, that this is someone who the president trusts and values, and what Mike Pompeo says, you can kind of take to the bank. And that's important.
Emily, what did you think of Tillerson's reign? What were his chief accomplishments?
The fact that I just drew a blank on what Tillerson's chief accomplishments were, I think, speaks to Tillerson's tenure as Secretary of State. And look, not all of this is Tillerson's responsibility, right? As we just heard, he personally and professionally was not in the same place as President Trump. He also came in and sort of set about dismantling the State Department bureaucracy. And now that's all well and good, except for the bureaucracy is what you need in order to get anything done at the State Department, right? And that's not a knock on the State Department. That's how government is set up. That's how it's structured. I think, obviously we just heard the example of North Korea. He also not went ahead but was directly undermined by the president on the Gulf State crisis last June, on the Iran deal, on any number of other things. I guess perhaps you could say that it was an accomplishment that he was able to assuage allies as President Trump worried them, because so much of what came out of the State Department was sort of the traditional State Department line. But I'm not even sure we can give him credit for that, because in his first meeting with NATO allies, he raised the question of, well, why are we – what do I say to American voters as to why we're paying for Ukraine? So in part – through his own fault and in part through sort of external factors, I would not credit Secretary Tillerson with a long list of accomplishments as Secretary of State. That said, there was sort of this understanding in the State Department when Pompeo was announced that, okay, we're back. We're at the table. We're going to be the ones crafting American diplomacy again.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, that may be. But again, it's because Pompeo was brought in, if he is indeed allowed to be brought in, because he sort of spoke in the same tongue as President Trump on U.S. foreign policy. So you'll be at the table. I don't know that you're that you that you'll necessarily like what you're going to be eating, but you'll be there.
Let's go to the phones. Joe in Woodbury has called in. Hi, Joe. What was your question or comment?
Well, what I have a comment on is that the way that you had framed the original question, can we indeed be America first and not be protectionist? I think that we indeed can. I think you should be America first, and just like every other country is going to do what's in their best interest. And if we don't do what's in our best interest, then I don't think we're upholding what we should be. You still have to be a good neighbor, though. You know, we still have to exist within a world system and be a world player here. So I think the framing of the question, to me, really required that type of a perspective, that America should be put first in our diplomacy. But yes, we still need to recognize we need to be a good neighbor on the world stage.
Thank you for calling in, Joe. You can call in with your question or comment at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Uri, how do we balance keeping America strong domestically and being a good neighbor? And what do people want from us, our allies?
Yeah, I think that's a great point that Joe made. I think when you think about the phrase that Donald Trump uses again and again, it has really defined his doctrine in the world, his foreign policy, this idea of America first. It's very alluring because, of course, why wouldn't, if you're the leader of the United States, why wouldn't you put the country you are leading and you are elected to lead first? I think the challenge is when you think deeply about how that phrase translates into policy is where the challenges arise. Because, you know, one way that one expert one watcher of Donald Trump's foreign policy described it to me is Donald Trump was – what he was saying with America first is that the United States has spent too long looking out for the world and it's time to look out for America. And, you know, this is about the primacy of the American interest above other interests. And the difficulty with that, the reason I think – I personally think it represents a huge break potentially from the way the U.S. foreign policy has been conducted over the last seven decades is that after World War II, the U.S. decided that the way to achieve American prosperity and American security was to build an order, to build things, a kind of an international system that favored U.S. interests but was also about collective security. So it was about defense, you know, treaties with alliances. It was about enabling free trade. It was about building international institutions and supporting those. And I think the way Donald Trump, since the 80s really, this is not something that came about in 2015 or 2016, he has often framed these things, especially in his unscripted moments, right, when he's not reading from a speech prepared for him, often frames these things as net negatives. That in some cases they've been successful, but often they have actually drained the U.S. of its resources, of its blood and treasure, and not actually benefited the United States and benefited American interests. And so, what I think will be very interesting to watch in this second year of Trump's presidency, when he's kind of more comfortable in the job, when he has advisors around him who may not 100% see things ideologically the way he does, but certainly are going to be robust supporters of his whatever policy decisions he makes, is does he go further than he did in his first year in challenging this global outward-looking order-building role that America has played? If he does, we could actually see a lot of changes in this international system that didn't really come about when the Cold War ended, and the reason for this order-building post-war strategy was an animating feature. We had, after the Cold War, there was a period where you could have had this questioning of America's role in the world. It didn't exactly happen. And then 9/11 happened, and we kind of stayed in this global role and just shifted focus to countering terrorism. This may be a moment of reckoning where we say, are we going to continue this role?
Yeah, Walter Russell Mead, you quoted him in an article, and he said, American presidents have believed that a global, outward-looking, order-building foreign policy was a necessary foundation for U.S. strategy and a peaceful, prosperous world. No longer. Emily, did this start with Trump, this change, or did this come about with earlier, with Obama and with Bush?
I'd like to make a few points. First of all, as Uri just said, if Trump has a foreign policy outlook or a worldview, it's this. You can go back decades and see that he has believed since the 1980s, that America is being taken advantage of.
Mm-hmm.
This despite the fact that America – playing its role in the international order, an order that in many ways America itself or the United States itself set up, kept America rich and safe and powerful. Did you see a rhetorical shift? Did George W. Bush speak like that? Did Obama speak like that? No, is the short answer, right? Did they act like – no, they didn't, right? George W. Bush certainly, I don't think, thought that America his foreign policy did not suggest that he wanted to change the international order in such a way that America was not – was less responsible for other parts of the world. I think with Obama, you heard a rhetorical shift and in some ways did see a foreign policy shift. I think that was more a – things like – yes, America is exceptional, but every country believes it's exceptional, right? I think in many ways that was more a response to the Bush years and a sort of a repositioning of America on the world stage. But it wasn't because he believed that or wanted to act like America was being robbed by the world. And Trump does, right? And that's his motivating foreign – if he has a motivating foreign policy belief, it's that. Will we see more of that in the next – few years, I don't know. It's interesting because on the one hand, that worldview suggests that you would pull back. On the other hand, recent additions to the team, right, Bolton and Pompeo, are quite, and then they may reject the word. That's fine. Are more hawkish than some of the people with whom Trump surrounded himself in the first year.
You both have mentioned that the State Department has been on the decline and that there are all kinds of job openings and empty offices. In an interview aired on NPR's Morning Edition, Ronan Farrow said he'd seen the State Department diminish more and more and more employees are let go. Let's listen to Farrow real quick.
There is this transformation in the way America exists in the world, that we are becoming a nation that no longer has negotiators and peacemakers, and in which our first response to crises is to shoot first and ask questions later or not at all.
So, Uri, is this a sea change that we're seeing with the State Department in decline and other – well, we think of that as the center of our foreign policy, but it's kind of not. We've got national security advisors. We've got the Pentagon. We've got the Defense Department. We've got advisors like Jared Kushner running our Middle East negotiations. Is the dismantling of the State Department mean less power for America, or will the building up of the military actually lead us to be still number one on the planet?
I think it is true that Donald Trump has presided over more of a militarized foreign policy, that he has invested a lot in the military. He's escalated only slightly, but he's escalated several of the conflicts that Obama was prosecuting, and that he has marginalized the State Department. That might change to a degree if he has an ally like Mike Pompeo at the head of state. I think, Ronan Farrow made a point that there's some truth to that we've become a country that shoots first and asks questions later. But I also think that's kind of a bit simplistic in terms of describing what Trump's foreign policy has done, because we did not shoot first with North Korea, right? We are about to engage in this flurry of diplomacy with North Korea. What we did is threaten many times to shoot. Right, which is different. Actually, if you think about the North Korea policy, yes, Trump threatened fire and fury. He threatened to completely destroy North Korea if it threatened us. But he has not taken military action. He started no completely new wars so far. I know we're early on in the Trump presidency, but he is instead, one way I think about it, this doesn't fully capture it either. It's hard to – there's no one phrase that captures Donald Trump's foreign policy. But I've been thinking a little bit of it as speak loudly and carry a big stick, as opposed to Teddy Roosevelt's speak softly and carry a big stick, which he actually announced for the first time at the Minnesota State Fair in 1901. Trump speaks loudly. He doesn't always follow through on what he says, but he actually almost sees the speaking loudly as a strategy in and of itself. One way I think about how Donald Trump thinks about diplomacy, often we think of diplomacy as dialogue, right? Mm-hmm. Communication. I think he also thinks that diplomacy is deception. It is speaking loudly and seeing what that gets you. speaking loudly in lots of different directions. One day you're Kim Jong-un's best friend, the next day you're his worst enemy. What does that yield in negotiations? And so I think that he has emphasized the military. He has decided he is not going to be this civil guy who doesn't bluster at all and just is very, very careful in everything he says, like past presidents. And he certainly seems to have less faith in diplomacy, certainly diplomacy not conducted by him, than in the military. But I don't think we are just going around shooting everything up in the world. That's not actually what Donald Trump has done.
And Emily, what do you think of President Trump's speak loudly and carry a big stick?
I think that's a good way of putting it. I think there are obviously foreign policy departures between this administration and the previous ones. I would not say that shooting first and asking questions later is the distinction that I would draw. Right? There were certainly foreign policy, misadventures of the past that where it became clear later that they were not fully thought through and the questions were still being asked. I think, in some ways, the speaking loudly, I cover foreign diplomats here in Washington, D.C. There are some, especially from certain parts of Eastern Europe, who are like, it's not bad that we have someone who keeps the other guy guessing, right? Mm-hmm. Perhaps that's what we need. We don't know. We're terrified every day, but maybe this will be good. On the other hand, I think that it speaks to this belief that Trump seems to have, or at least has articulated, that diplomacy sort of rests within him, right? That he knows what he's doing, and he knows that he's going to say one thing and then he could change his mind, but it's okay because he sort of holds all the cards and you don't know what he's going to do next, and it's good if they're on their toes, and just let him in a room with Kim Jong-un and he'll figure the rest out. And there's a reason that we don't typically just let U.S. presidents in the room with Kim Jong-un or with anyone, and that's that it's more complicated than any one person can instinctually understand and see himself out of, right? And I think that's why, the Japanese are wary. That's why some in the U.S. Policy creating community are wary. He speaks loudly, and you never know exactly what he's going to say.
How well does it speak loudly, and you never know what he's going to say? Work with our allies like Germany and France is the first. We're having a state visit from Macron this week, who's going to go before Congress, and he announced this weekend that he's going to ask for American military might, essentially. I can't remember the exact quote. He said he was going to ask for some militarization. How well does his Trump's speak loudly work with our allies?
I think it makes our allies uncomfortable. Macron is here on his, or will be here on his charm offensive, and certainly has sort of tried his own way of getting Trump to say what he, that is Macron, wants him to say. I think it certainly does not work very well with Germany. We'll see what Chancellor Merkel says later in the week. And again, the reason is that, as we were saying earlier, for decades, American presidents have spoken, some more loudly than others, but it's basically been about upholding a certain order, upholding a certain rule book to which Americans largely wrote the rules. And it's not necessarily that anymore, right? So when Trump tweets out that actually it's a good thing that we get along with Putin, or, that North Korea has promised denuclearization when in fact it hasn't, or any number of other things, right? That is not, and he does this without letting, without ambassadors in many places, without letting these countries know beforehand, right? That is not necessarily something that's going to give solace to America's closest allies.
Emily Tamkin is a staff writer at Foreign Policy, and my other guest is Uri Friedman. He's a staff writer at The Atlantic. They're both in Washington, D.C. Uri, who is, if Pompeo takes over as Secretary of State, who is he competing with to have the president's ear on foreign policy? Who do you think really is helping guide Trump's vision right now?
There's Defense Secretary James Mattis, who has really been remarkable in that this has been a very tumultuous White House in terms of staffing. There's been a lot of turnover and a lot of people who have had a falling out with the president. And Jim Mattis has managed to stick through it all. And, you know, there are signs that maybe there was some disagreement over the recent Syria strikes, that Mattis wanted something very limited and wanted to be have some kind of symbolic, you know, action that sent a signal that use of chemical weapons by Bashar al-Assad was not acceptable, but didn't want to do anything more than that, and that the president was pushing back. So there are signs of disagreement, but he is one person. Another person is John Bolton, who is Donald Trump's new national security advisor, who is, I would say, you know, because the staffing decisions happened around the same time, people have kind of been lumping in John Bolton and Mike Pompeo as like-minded people. I would say there are more disagreements. One, we have much more to go on John Bolton in terms of his views on foreign policy than Mike Pompeo. When you're CIA director, as Pompeo is currently, you don't make many policy pronouncements. And so we don't know a ton about how he thinks about things. And before that, he was a congressman who did sit on an intelligence committee and had his views known, especially in his opposition to Barack Obama's Iran deal. But is a little more – he's not a completely known entity. John Bolton often talks about using military action to solve international problems. He was a member of the Bush administration and was very controversial, so controversial that he wasn't approved by Congress to be George W. Bush's ambassador to the United Nations. So those are some of the people that Mike Pompeo will be competing with. But let's remember, the biggest person he will be competing with is the president himself. This is the president who really has strong views, not necessarily always in some kind of ideologically coherent way, but he has many, because he moves around a lot in terms of where he thinks about where the U.S. should go on policy. But he has really proven over the last year that he is the ultimate decider on these things and that he will kind of marginalize people who tell him no too many times. And so I think the biggest question will be when Mike Pompeo has disagreements with the president, for example, on Russia, where Mike Pompeo has been much more aggressive in terms of countering Vladimir Putin. And Donald Trump personally, if not his administration, has been much more wary to confront Vladimir Putin. So when those kinds of disagreements come up, who will win out? Will Mike Pompeo be a loyal defender once the decision is made? That's something we don't know yet.
Emily, what do you think is at the top of Trump's agenda on foreign policy? Obviously, North Korea. We've discussed that. What else?
Yeah, I think it's North Korea and it's Syria. And I think that it's his – I mean, I'm not going to use the phrase that he used for it, but the fight against terrorism, as he defines it, which is, you know, primarily – by radical Islamist groups. It's those three things. I think if you are not one of those three, you're sort of off the agenda. Other than trade, right, which goes back to this idea that we were talking about earlier, which is that President Trump's foreign policy view is dictated by this idea that other countries are trying to take advantage of the United States. So if you are not a pressing nuclear issue, if you're not a country that's been in a war zone for years, or if you're not trade, I'm not sure that President Trump is thinking about you.
John in Minneapolis called, and we would have put him on, but his phone line was really noisy, apparently. And he says the Trump strategy is not thought out. His military plan doesn't have an exit strategy. Isn't his military plan to exit? Like, we're talking about Syria, I think, in particular. Isn't it his just try to get out of there as soon as possible?
Yes and no, because if what you're trying to do is get out as quickly as possible, if that's which is indeed what Trump had said he was going to do, you don't then strike Syria, right? Mm-hmm. This will be something that's really interesting to watch this week because President Macron is here visiting from France. He had said, oh, I convinced Trump to stay in Syria. Then he had to walk that back after Trump said, no, Macron never said that. But he is someone who has had a close relationship with President Trump and who is going to try to use that closeness to get what he wants out of Trump, which in this particular case is for the United States to remain involved in Syria. We'll have to see whether that will work, right? If Trump were to turn on Macron, it would not be the only close sort of head of state, head of government relationship to change, right? We had Shinzo Abe, Prime Minister of Japan, and the first year, things were going swimmingly. More recently, with Japan left out of the North Korea summit announcement with no tariffs awarded to Japan on trade, that seems to have turned. That could still happen with Macron, particularly if he makes statements that Trump then turns around and says, well, I didn't agree to that. Why would you say that I said that? But U.S. involvement in Syria is one thing, one to watch this week with Macron in the town.
Our phone number here is 1-800-242-2828 or 651-227-6000. We're talking about the future of the State Department and American diplomacy. Uri, what I want to know is, with the decline of the State Department and the numbers of actual just people working at the State Department, as Trump keeps his eye on the big headlines and the big foreign policy questions, what other global problems are being overlooked that would normally be taken care of by that infrastructure, the State Department, that just keeps carrying on?
Well, I think one you'll see really soon is this North Korea summit that we don't have a lot of – we have people who have been working on this issue. We don't have a lot of people who are steeped in the history of negotiations with North Korea. In fact, when Mike Pompeo came on a lot of Sunday shows when he was nominated to be Secretary of State, he was saying, you know, I spent this past weekend reading up on the history. Well, I'm glad he's doing his homework, but there are a lot of people who were previously in the State Department who had a lot of experience actually negotiating with North Koreans. We don't see a lot of that. So this will actually be an interesting test. You know, one of the interesting things, because Donald Trump has, you know, questioned so many assumptions, this is almost like a political science paper or experiment that's actually happening in the real world. You know, all people talk about how you need expertise, you need people at all levels. You start at the lower level of negotiations and go up to the higher level. Well, we're having all of those assumptions tested right now. And so one of the assumptions that will be tested is, do you need a deep bench of expertise in the State Department to be able to negotiate effectively with North Korea? Or do you need, you know, Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un in a room and they figure out the broad details of a deal and then it goes from there. So I think that's one thing that'll be interesting to see. That's not going unattended, as you mentioned. Like, we're actually addressing that, but we're addressing it with a thinned out State Department. For example, we have no ambassador right now in South Korea. We don't have a lot of expertise, as I mentioned. There was actually a guy named Jo Yoon who was at the State Department who was our main point person for negotiations with North Korea several months ago, and went through this thing called the New York Channel. There was a North Korean diplomat in New York, and he would often converse with them. He is gone. So we'll see how that affects the negotiations and their outcome. Beyond that, one thing that I think about a lot is Russia. Russia has really, you know, under Vladimir Putin over the last few years, decided that they are going to be a spoiler to a lot of Western goals in the world, and that they are also going to be aggressive, that they're going to use propaganda and disinformation campaigns, that they are going to test limits of what they can do in the world to achieve their interests. And this requires a kind of united – one, it requires robust American diplomacy, and then beyond that, it requires a kind of a united front among Western democracies who feel threatened by this in Europe and the United States and North America to act in a concerted fashion. We saw that a bit when the United States and its European allies and Canada all expelled diplomats in response to a suspected nerve agent attack in the United Kingdom that was blamed on Russia. But the one thing that I think we'll have to see if a State Department can be up to the challenge is, how do you make that a sustained effort to counter Russia and to avoid these kinds of flare-ups? And one thing I'll note about Rex Tillerson's tenure is that Congress actually gave him, you know, I think it was something around $80 million to counter Russian propaganda, and that money went unused. So Congress is trying to push the State Department in the direction of coming up and standing up to the Russian challenge, and that has so far not exactly been the case, in part because Donald Trump has expressed reluctance to do so.
Emily, do you think the State Department has what it takes to counteract Russia's voice in the world?
I think that the State Department could have what it takes, right, to counter Russian aggression, to counter Russian meddling, to put forth a concerted effort with its European allies. But in order for it to do that, the State Department needs to be given a certain level of prominence within U.S. diplomacy, right? If the State Department is sidelined, it cannot do that. And it also will take a certain appetite from Pompeo to push something that Trump himself has proven time and again to be very hesitant to do, which is to sort of put himself at odds with Russian President Vladimir Putin. So, for example, this past summer, Congress passed the Countering America's Adversaries Through Sanctions Act. The Treasury Department has sanctioned Russian individuals and entities based on that legislation. The State Department did not. And the reason given was sort of, well, you know, our diplomacy has already stopped other countries from buying Russian military goods, and we're not going to tell you which ones, but trust us, our diplomacy is working. Well, if you're a sidelined State Department, no, it's very difficult for Congress or for the American public to trust you, right? And so it's not just about making sure that the United States State Department works with its European allies to come up with a strategy to counter so-called Russian aggression. It's also a matter of the U.S., Congress, the State Department, the Treasury Department, the U.N. ambassador who just just last week Nikki Haley announced that there would be new sanctions on Russia over Syria. A day later, it was announced that they wouldn't be coming in, right? It's also about ensuring that there's a coordinated U.S. effort, which in the first year of the Trump presidency, there was not.
Brenda in Woodbury has called in. Let's bring her up. And hi, Brenda. What have you got to say?
Good morning. Thank you. What I see is that what Donald Trump believes is what's in his best interest, and everything else comes from that. So everything he says and does is calculated. And, for example, if you beat people up enough, you'll get them to do what you want, or you get rid of them. And that we're even beating up on our allies, and that is a really important asset. And then finally, I'm even wondering, like, and this is really out there, but was Rex Tillerson chosen because of his Russian contacts, and that's what mattered to Donald Trump, at least then?
All right. Thank you very much, Brenda. So Donald Trump working in his best interest mainly. Do you think that's true? Emily?
Again, I think that Donald Trump's dominating, and I know that I sound like a broken record here, but I do think that insofar as Trump has a foreign policy worldview or ideology, it's that he personally and America in general has been taken advantage of, has given more than it's received, and that he wants to change that. And, you know, there are perhaps instances in which that view could align with America's best interest as a whole, with the transatlantic alliance's best interests as a whole, with, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't necessarily mean that.
One other thing Brenda had said that I saw in the notes that she didn't say, she said that we're losing our standing in the world. And if we did cede our standing in the world, who's there to take over? Is it China? Is it Russia? Uri, who do you think would step in as global leader?
Yeah, there are a lot of different theories on that, and each one would have, you know, an impact on the way the world looks in 5, 10, 15 years. Some people say China, though China doesn't seem to have many aspirations to it has use its economic influence to, you know, build infrastructure in Africa and around the world, and has really been building up its clout. It's also been building up its military in its region. But it has yet to kind of, other than its actions in the Security Council, because it's a permanent member, it has not, you know, gone around the world trying to solve every problem and lead every effort on international challenges. So where it's done that the most, I would say, is in the Paris Climate Agreement by signing up to efforts to combat climate change. Russia certainly has views of how it wants to be a leader in the world. Again, here it is. I would say it's more pronounced in China in terms of it wants to have a seat at the table just with the United States and, you know, solve everything from North Korea to the Iran nuclear challenge to Ukraine. So it has kind of positioned itself as a player on a lot of issues, also in Syria. In Europe, I would say also look to certain leaders. Initially, when Donald Trump was elected, it almost looked like Angela Merkel was going to play that role. She was standing up for Western solidarity and taking its future into its own hands and standing up for liberal democracy. She has faded a bit, I would say, somewhat surprisingly, in part because she just barely won an election and then had to form a coalition. So she's very focused internally. Same with Theresa May. and Britain, who is dealing with Brexit, Britain leaving the European Union. And I would say, actually, the person who has most stepped into the role most recently has been Emmanuel Macron, who is currently visiting the United States and the first state visit of the Trump presidency. And he has really stood up for Europe and Western efforts to be a leader in the world. But what he has not done is said the EU or France are going to take the role that the United States played before. He has been trying to say we need to step up but do it in concert with the United States, even if we disagree on a lot of policy issues. There's no European leadership without American leadership in partnership. Those are kind of the various players and aspirants to the role America's played. America is still playing the role to a large degree. And then there's another option, which is that no one really steps up to that role. Yeah. And we see a different kind of world than we have over the last several decades, where there's been, certainly since the Cold War, the United States up at the forefront. If there's not that one country or one block of countries at the forefront, you know, the world will continue. Things will go on, but it'll look a lot different than it has in the past.
Bruce in Minneapolis has called. Hi, Bruce. What's your question?
Hi. Curious about the State Department and if it meddles in other countries' affairs. And if it does, is it doing it more or less under Trump?
Do you mean meddling like Russia is in our elections, or what do you mean?
Well, yeah, in the terms that you brought up, meddling, mm-hmm. I've heard it a few times. To prevent Russia from meddling, mm-hmm. there are sanctions and stuff like that. So
okay.
Whatever you think Russia is doing, do we do that? And if so, is it more or less under Trump?
Thanks so much, Bruce. Emily, I think this is kind of a basic question. A lot of people don't know how the State Department exactly works and how embassies and consulates work. How do they spread America's voice around the world besides the Secretary of State going out and giving speeches? How does it work?
Yeah, of course. I think, first of all, is the State Department meddling? I think depends on who you ask, right? If I were to ask, say, higher-ups in the Kremlin, I'm sure that they would say, yes, it does. The State Department sends ambassadors and diplomats and foreign service officers all over the world. Well, ideally, it sends them all over – or in theory, it sends them all over the world to provide consular services, to promote American soft power and culture, to conduct diplomatic conversations. But I think what Bruce was getting at is, well, what about America gets involved in other countries' affairs too? America gets involved in other countries' elections too? To which I say, Bruce Touche, that's a fair point. That is something that America has been accused of doing, at times fairly, at times not. Is it doing it more or less under Trump? I would think, it's still involved in other countries' affairs. Whether or not you think that that's the same as sending citizens to another country, having them set up PayPal accounts with stolen identities and the posting on social media and this, that, and the other thing. That I leave that for Bruce to decide. Obviously, American lawmakers see a difference, right? See a distinction between what we do and what Russia did that got these sanctions in place. I think that there are plenty in Russia who see them as being the same.
Uri, what do you think?
I think one thing that has been pronounced, and it hasn't just come from the State Department but also from the president himself, is there has been less emphasis overall on the promotion of democracy and human rights during Trump's presidency than in the past. And that was one way in which the State Department and American officials more broadly got involved in other countries' politics, right? They would stand up for human rights and promote and support civil society groups and those kinds of NGOs that are promoting democracy, things like that. Donald Trump has done it, and the administration has done it selectively. So they've done it in North Korea, for example, pointing out human rights abuses in North Korea. They've done it in Venezuela. But in general, they have not, and they've adopted more of a transactional approach. So, for example, on China, Donald Trump basically went to the Chinese and said, I have two priorities here. I have North Korea stopping its nuclear weapons program, and I have trade. I want fair trade with you. If you help me on those things, I'll be very happy. Nowhere in those two things is China's suppression of activists and dissidents. It's human rights abuses. It's censorship of the internet. That has really not come up. And I think while other presidents also had other priorities, they certainly made that part of the agenda with China in ways that the Trump presidency hasn't.
Emily, if you were Secretary of State, if you were taking it over, what kind of changes would you want to see in the department? Does it need to be streamlined? Does it need to be updated? What needs to happen to it?
Oh, gosh. If I were Secretary of State, my life would be so
vastly different
than what it is now
it is.
That I don't. Well, I don't know if amazing is the word that I would use.
I think that what
those who are working in the department want is for their department to be heard within the broader administration, for them to feel like their work has value, for them to feel like it is making it to every corner of the globe. Mm-hmm. And that's the prerogative of any Secretary of State, right? That your words are heard by the president, they're understood by the president, the long term, the people who have dedicated their lives to diplomacy, that they're being heard, that they're being used to the best of their, you know, ability, that the knowledge that they have is being passed on and echoing throughout the administration. And we will see if Mike Pompeo, should he become Secretary of State, if he can do that.
I read a quote this week that said, diplomacy is in many ways the practice of ego-soothing and interest-placating. Uri, is there a need for that still? Do we need to have the State Department around the world ego-soothing, interest-placating? And how does it work with the strong Defense Department in the Pentagon?
Yeah, I think, well, one thing, we mentioned this a bit earlier, Emily touched on it as well, is that unpredictability, the speaking loudly, the being tough to get to promote American interests, that can potentially work with adversaries. It's a lot harder on allies who expect predictability and reliability and a certain way of partners treating each other. For example, Emmanuel Macron, the French president, said, you know, why is Trump considering tariffs on Europe? Allies don't get into trade wars with each other. So I think there is some placating that needs to be happening, some soothing, if that's where the Trump administration wants to go. It's certainly where what allies feel right now. But the question is whether they'll be interested in placating or whether they'll want that, you know, they don't mind allies being a little more disturbed. But more broadly in the State Department, I just think that, you know, the Secretary of State is America's chief diplomat, its face to the world. What I mentioned before is Donald Trump is challenging and questioning a lot of these assumptions about U.S. grand strategy over the last seven decades. We often talked about second-order questions. So what should our Syria strategy be? What should our policy be to Russia? He is bringing back first-order questions. Like, what is America's role in the world? What does America want? What are we supposed to be doing? And so when you talk about what is Trump's Syria strategy, well, that's kind of secondary to the question of, is America just about fighting terrorists that want to affect us? Or is it about challenging Iranian influence in the Middle East and being a power broker in the Middle East? You know, and I think what the next Secretary of State needs to do is help define what America's role in the world is going forward. And that is right now undefined. And that's why there's a lot of placating that needs to be done.
Do you think Pompeo has it in him to guide Trump and also take over the Department of State at a time when it's got, you know, the people that are working there are really they're having a hard time in there. They've got low esteem and tough couple of years. He's got a lot on his plate. Is it all going to be able to get done?
I mean, it's certainly a tall order, but I think Mike Pompeo, one thing that was notable about his tenure as the director of the CIA is he did really advocate for the organization. He was a big promoter of their work. For many accounts, not all accounts, boosted morale there, especially at a time when the president himself was challenging a lot of the intelligence findings surrounding the Russian interference in the U.S. election. And so I think he will be an advocate for the State Department. He will try to plus up, you know, morale and, you know, reactivate people to help solve the world's problems. So I think he is up to the task. The challenge is that, one, there's a depleted staffing issue, and two, it's just a lot of these problems right now are really big. North Korea and solving its nuclear weapons program has been something that has eluded U.S. administrations for 25 years. So this is not something that you can just, like, jump into, especially when you jump in and you're confirmed, if he is confirmed, and then a few weeks later, the president is meeting with Kim Jong-un. So he doesn't have a lot of time. So I think these are really big challenges. He may struggle with some and do really well with others, but I think he is certainly going to be an advocate for his institution in a way that his predecessor, Rex Tillerson, was not.
Emily, where are we quick on funding for the State Department? Is it looking like it's going to be cut some more, or how much of a cut are they looking at?
Congress actually pushed back against the last cut that this administration proposed. So in 2019, I think that's up to the new players in the game.
All right. Thank you both very much for joining me. Emily Tamkin is a staff writer at Foreign Policy, and Uri Freeman is a staff writer at The Atlantic. They both joined me from Washington, D.C. I really appreciate both of you joining me.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
You're listening to Minnesota Public Radio.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.